questions you always had, the answers you were never given, the place to seek the truth. Welcome to Veritas.
There are many underwater harbors, channels, and canals on the Atlantic and Gulf Coasts that are covered with vestiges and remnants of a sophisticated and large culture or civilization that existed before current sea level rose an average of 5'5". Evidence shows many harbor areas on much of New York's Long Island Sound and other East Coast locations, Florida Gulf Coast, the Louisiana Delta, and Mexico, to have been quote-unquote worked and inhabited by a very large and technically sophisticated population of canal builders during some remote period. Both Florida and New York have extensive offshore harbor and canal channel systems that are at least 7,000 years old. The material presented tonight you will not hear on the mainstream media. We bring you not an archaeologist trained by academia, but an amateur researcher who stepped outside the proverbial box and has been exploring for decades what's under the water. What he says he has observed from the sky could rewrite the history of the world. He has identified patterns that appear to be man-made or at least non-natural. Some of these canals are longer, wider, and deeper than the Panama Canal, which about 7,000 years ago would have required some serious innovation, underwater sunken systems that require technology to produce that is beyond or at least equivalent to what we have today. Who are these builders, and how was civilization 7,000 years ago? Greetings, I'm your host, Mel Fabregas at Veritas Radio. If you want to listen to tonight's full interview and all of our material, click on the subscribe button at veritasradio.com. And if you want to get in touch with me, want to be a guest on this radio program, have a guest suggestion, or have feedback, just click on the contact button of our website at veritasradio.com. I always love to hear from you. Tonight's special guest is John M. Jansen Jr., who has been researching and writing about the canals and harbors he discovered in 2008, and has written two books on the subject, Ancient Canal Builders and Earth Epochs, both available for free on his website at earthepochs.com. And John Jansen joins us directly from my old stomping grounds in the Sunshine State of Florida. Hello, Mr. Jansen, and welcome to Veritas.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you inviting me on.
My pleasure. May I call you John?
Yes, you can, please.
Well, first of all, John, how did you begin your research? Let's begin with the genesis of it all.
I've been a general researcher and with life interest in ancient archaeology, the anomalies around the Earth back to the days of the early Erich von Däniken days, back in the late 50s, early 60s. And as I got closer to retirement about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, I had the time available to really start doing more research. And one day I was looking at some Civil War stuff, really did not related to this subject at all. And in looking at some of the canals in Louisiana, or at looking at some of the Civil War buildings and information of how the war was fought around New Orleans, I saw a fort on the Mississippi River, and beside it was some very large, for lack of a better word, canals. And they looked out of place. They didn't look right to the size of the fort and the area. And as I began to look at it in closer detail, I'm talking Google Earth, back in the early days of Google Earth.
Oh, yeah.
As I began to look at that particular set of canals closer, I realized that there were miles upon miles of similar wide, what we call paddlehead canals. And they were available. They were there during the Civil War because the initial drawings that I looked at were hand drawings of the time. And I went, huh, I don't think they were building canals prior to the Civil War that were degraded and and sealed it in by the time of the Civil War means they were older. I don't think they were doing that at that time. I started looking for information and said, when Louisiana canals were being built for the oil industry and exploration, natural resource explanation, logging, and so on, which, by the way, was quite large in Louisiana back in the late 1800s. So I started looking at all of that data to see if any natural resource folks were building canals of any kind in Louisiana prior to the Civil War. And I couldn't find the first thing, not the first piece of evidence of anything. And I went, maybe there's something here. And I just kept looking at it. I spent about a year and a half in researching the Louisiana canals that led me further and further afield until I was in Florida and Texas and South Mexico and so on. And I began to get a much larger picture of canals that looked like these original, what we call paddlehead canals that I'd seen on the pre-Civil War map. And the Google Earth images were much clearer than anything the maps had. And I was able to trace many, many miles of these canals that just did not fit any kind of history that we have. For our exploration for natural resources and so on. And I didn't have any proof. I didn't have any close pictures. But I just kept researching. And as I got further out into Florida, both Florida coast, and I live in the Orlando area, so I was able to go to both coasts to look at information that I found or try to research it. And I began to find anomalies in Florida that just absolutely were pre-current civilization, our own technology. And as I did that, I began to understand, look at other areas of research around how to identify the age of things that were underwater, like these canals. And I started finding out about ocean rise and the dating process, not archaeologically, but geologically, being able to date ocean rise and levels of what we call the shoulder or tidal shoulder based, put dates to it based on carbon dating and other efforts, research efforts that folks were doing to do dating through ocean rise, which led me backwards to the being able to date a specific period in time when several major events, and I'll call them cataclysmic kind of events, occurred simultaneously, or in the historic record, nearly simultaneously, relatively speaking. One of the first pieces of evidence that came out of it was that 7,000 years ago, based on ocean rise information, there were several major environmental impacts that were catastrophic in nature that all coincided almost exactly to 7,000 years ago. And that became the real core of Earth epochs. I began to look at another set of events that were closer to our own time in historical record, and we'll call that the Earth axis tilt, but in reality, most folks will recognize it as the day that the sun stood still in Joshua, in Joshua's Canaan, when after Moses and Joshua left Egypt, they went, transferred through the Sinai Desert, went to Canaan. And at a given date that we pretty well know almost exactly when it was, the world recorded in in many of written forms of the earth, of this earth standing still for less than half a day. And the long day and the long night, which is a world recorded event across many cultures around the world, and they define what happened, how long it happened, and when it happened. And I went, that date coincides almost exactly with the date of the Santorini explosion in the Mediterranean. That's the caldera that exploded on Santorini Island. And another piece of evidence on that is that at that time, at that almost exact time, which is about 3,450 years ago, many cultures, the Chinese, the Mesopotamian, Sumerian, Egyptian, and even the Mayans and Aztecs, changed their early calendar about that time and added 5 1/4 days to their calendars. And it's kind of self-evident that if the Egyptians, Sumerians had a 360-day calendar prior to that time, and they had to add 5 1/4 days to their extant calendar, means that there's probably a change in the solar path of the Earth to a greater 5 1/4 days, or those cultures wouldn't have added those days.
Let's dissect this step by step, John, because this is really fascinating, and I hope that everybody listens to the last minute, because I have a lot of notes here and a lot of good information. But let's go step by step. I'm sure you'd agree, John, that in order to find out who and why these canals were built, we must find out when they were built. And you've done a good job dissecting this. So you found out that it's about 7,000 years ago. Now, these calderas, could it be that when the Earth stopped, for those who believe that it rotates, that volcanoes erupted not only there, but probably around the world, and the soil displacement or the lava, could that be the culprit of what made the oceans rise?
No, I really don't think so. The dating is pretty precise, that the explosion of Santorini and the breach of the Gibraltar Strait at the same time was at a specific time, 3,448 years ago, almost exactly. The great event, what we call the last great cataclysm at 7,000 years ago, was a precise event that also has many records geologically that date them to that exact time, so they're different. The great explosions, the building of the West Coast as a result of earthquakes is probably a different date. I have that, in my opinion, the great earthquakes of the West Coast, the building of the Rocky Mountains and those. And I've been on digs in the Rocky Mountains where we found whole beaches of clamshells that are relatively fresh, thousands of feet above sea level in the Rockies. That all occurred at the Younger Dryas impact event of 12,900 years ago, in my opinion.
Lake Titicaca. It has Lake Titicaca in South America. It has
exactly
sea life
Lake Titicaca,
up there.
Pumapunku. Tiwanaku, all of those, and the high cities in the Andes, all occurred from that major impact, and that's all part of my next book. I really don't have much of it in Earth Epics, but the whole Younger Dryas cataclysm and the earlier ones. See, what I'm saying to you, we're talking about three cataclysms right here, relatively close to each other. A lighter one at 3,600 years ago that was not a world-class population-killing cataclysm. It was a more of a localized catastrophe than a world or global cataclysm. There was one at 7,000 years ago, which is the last great cataclysm, and it was quite devastating. And the precursor civilization to that was the biblical Elohim or Anunnaki was before that cataclysm. And there's some argument that those may really predate the Younger Dryas event of 12,900 years ago.
What about the canals? When, in your estimation, were they built? What year, more or less, or years?
The years of what?
The canals. When were they built?
The canals were built prior to 7,000 years ago. Almost the civilization grew up sometime between 7,600 years ago and 7,000 years ago, between that period. I don't know exactly when, but it was wiped out, universally wiped out 7,000 years ago. My argument in terms of the supporting evidence is that we can date the canals by ocean rise. The major canals that I've identified in my book are generally speaking between 6 and 10 feet under the current ocean level. Okay. And we know without a doubt that ocean rise over the last 7,000 years is almost exactly, it's really not, it's about 8 foot, give or take. Maybe a little less, maybe closer to between 6 and 7.5. So if anything is underwater or on the tidal shoulder that is at least 10 foot underwater, it's not even an argument that it's at least 7,000 years old. A perfect example that your listeners may be familiar with is the Bimini Road. The Bimini Road, without question, is non-natural. It's built into a form that looks like a J, the letter J, beside some other land barrier, artifacts. And it resides at something around a 12 foot under the ocean level. Its shoreline would have been about 12 foot lower than the ocean is today. And that's a element that anyone can go look at. It's there. It's at a depth that we understand how old it is. And the Bimini Road is something around 7,500 to 7,600 years ago. Now, if the cataclysm occurred 7,000 years ago, it means there was technology here for at least 600 years before the cataclysm. So the harbors that I've seen evidence of, particularly New York harbors, the ones going down into Mexico, all are on a tidal shoulder that is slightly more than 6 foot deep, meaning they were built before 7,000 years ago. And that civilization, we know pretty clearly who they were because about 20 years ago, some contractors dug up some bodies in Florida called the Wendover Bog people out of Titusville. And those bodies were buried in peat in graves that the pH in the water in the grave area was so neutral that the body still had
the brain matter,
brain material in the brain cavity. So they were able to not only date them, they were able to haplogroup blood test them and be able to put haplogroup markers to who they were. Based on that initial studies that have been decried now by academia that's screaming because they can't live with the fact that we had civilized people here 7,600 years ago, particularly in America. But the test that they ran through proved that their haplogroup was Gaelic Irish, We didn't call them Irish then. We called them Celts, and who are also related to the Berbers in Spain, the Basque in Spain, and the Berbers in Africa, and same haplogroup folks. So there was Europeans on the Florida coast 7,600 years ago, and they were buried in woven cloth or machine woven material, which means machine weaving, by the way, is a technology that is recognized as level two civilization technology. It follows well after agriculture and things like that, because that's where we initially got our cotton and flax and various things to weave with, was from agriculture. So weaving followed it, and here we have machine weaving 7,600 years ago in Florida. So you look at all that data and you go, maybe the Mormons had it closer to right than anybody gives them credit for. I'm not advocating at all for Mormons, please understand. But that's a story they relatively tell.
Well, let's stay there with the Wendover Bog people, because this is fascinating. There's an archaeological site there in Florida for anybody to see. And what you're saying about the pH of the water, there must have been a lot of consideration to do it that way so that they could be mummified in a way where thousands of years later we could find their bodies with the brain matter intact. Now, you've seen or you've heard of these mummies that have been found in China. Of all places, all these red-haired mummies with woven cloth, and the Chinese don't like to talk about it. In fact, there, as you probably know, there are pyramids in China. The government pays the farmers money to bury them and to plant crops on top of them, because they don't want the world to think that there was another race in that part of the world. Do you think that those people that we're finding in China are the same Wendover Bog people?
They're relatively close. The ones in China, many of them have Celtic kind of clothing, woven clothing. They have features of European features. So to answer your question, I don't get into the politics of it very much. I just look at the evidence
Great.
Of what it is, and I don't draw a lot of conclusions of why academia hides it or decries it or calls it, you know, junk science or whatever they do. They're trying to maintain a coherent timeline that supports Darwinian evolution and or gradualism and to maintain their teaching processes. It's real hard to change the history books every year.
No, and I understand why you probably have been attacked by them, and we can talk about that later, because they're preserving the status quo, their curriculum, as you said, the evolution and all that stuff. But you also mentioned oceanographers. Have they been able to date the tidal shelf or the shoulder and the water table rise since the ice melt and how high it has risen?
Absolutely, and that's where most of my data comes from, is from the oceanographers that do that work. They date many things on tidal shoulders. They date coral outcrops at particular levels where they see tidal action or wave action on those. The oceanographers have a very rigid record that's about 13,000 years old. It goes back to the Younger Dryas and earlier, maybe a little earlier, maybe 14,000. And it's fairly well accepted. Now, please understand that there are rigid gradualists that argue against it regardless. But there's a wide range of oceanographers and some geologists that accept their work as being rigid in terms of dating. And that dating suggests that there's been at least 7 cataclysms, 3 of which were catastrophes, and 4 of which were major changing cataclysms over the Holocene, or since the end of the last ice age. And oceanographers' information supports that almost 100%.
Okay, let's go back in time then, because now we've pinpointed that these channels, harbors, canals were built around, would you say, 7,000 years ago, correct?
Well, there's 2 sets. Understand, there's 1 set. The major long canals, the big ones, the major ones were built before 7,000 years ago. There's another subset that are smaller and not as big and not as wide and not as sophisticated, that were built prior to the Earth axis, still 3,600 years ago. But they're much clearer and much, because they're newer or closer to us, they're easier to date, and they're easier to define as what period they're from. But they're it's a different civilization, not the same one at all. So 3,448 years ago, one group, and 7,000 years ago, another group.
But do you think that responsibility may go to these Wendover Bog people?
The earlier ones, the Wendover Bog people were related to the 7,000-year-ago ancient canal builders, but the ancient canal builders were not the Wendover Bog people, if that makes sense. What the Wendover Bog people were in effect what we were as a civilization 250, 300 years ago. 250 years ago, 70% of the United States population wore Indian buckskin and carried flint knives. Okay? 70% of the population here. So they, even though we had major urban populations, we still had vast populations of people that were living much more primitive. You follow? Not just Native Americans, but other Europeans that lived on the fringes of technology and civilization. Those fringe folks are what the Wendover Bog people were to the ancient canal builders.
You mentioned 3,600 years. That number always reminds me of the late Zechariah Sitchin and Nibiru. What do you think happened? Do you lend credence to this planet Nibiru that has an elongated orbit and comes every 3,600 years?
Well, the last great cataclysm occurred 7,000 years ago, and the Earth axis tilt occurred almost exactly 3,600 years later. Now, that's the only period. The problem I've got with Zechariah Sitchin, and I'll make enemies by saying this, but his argument is not supported by the historical facts that every 3,600 years, and we have enough geology to know the difference, that it doesn't occur on a 3,600-year basis scale, even though the last one did. I think that's more luck than it is circumstances to support the Nibiru cycle. Here's what I think. The reasons that we have cataclysms that we can date and that go back into the pre-ice age, they occur on an average cycle of about 7,000 years. We know that from the geology. If you look at the geological column and dig it up, we've gone down 55,000 feet in search of oil and done core drills down that deep. The changes between sandstone and limestone, which is earth and seabed, are exact changes at one period of time. There's no transition. It's just instantaneous. So whatever happens in the cataclysm that causes that change, it occurs almost instantaneously. So if they go back, if we can read, which is what my next book is about, is those cataclysms over the Ice Age. and we could read hundreds of them in core samples and in ice core samples. We know that they're not 3,600 years apart. They're just not. They average, some of them, many of them are about 4,000 years apart. Some of them are much longer, some as great as 70 or 80,000 years of one stability.
Are there any, John, that are infrequent specific intervals, say every, say 3,000 or every 2,000 years, so that we can predict and prepare?
No. They average, like I say, they run all over the map. They average about 7,000 years on average. That doesn't mean that they're every 7,000 years at all. Lots of them are 3,500, 4,500, 5,500 years. Lots of them, some of them are less than that. There isn't anything that says there's any repetitive cycle like 3,600 years.
Right.
Just doesn't exist.
But what are they, John? Are they cosmic? Are they local? Are they man-made with technology of people in that time that perhaps evolved more technologically than spiritually, and we wipe ourselves out?
Well, you're getting into my third book that I'm writing right now, but my response to that is, have there been, look, civilizations can be measured on all kinds of levels of technology and so forth. Have there been civilizations that were considered by most experts to be a level three transition technology, even though we've got computers and this technology you and I are dealing with,
right,
we're still only advanced to about a level three, maybe transitioning to a level four. There have been other technologies on Earth that are so distinctly different than us that I'm not competent to really assign what level of that technology was. But our written records, particularly the Hindu records, the Mahabharata, and those, the Michael Cremo kind of stuff, for any of your listeners that follow Michael, they have the best written records that go back, based on their records, 300,000-400,000 years, and they suggest that there was technology more advanced than we are, and I tend to think that that's pretty close to accurate. I don't see any reason that we would have that kind of data retained as cultural data if there weren't some actual truth to it. And the evidence out there that I've run into in terms of civilization say that there were at least three or four highly advanced technologies. And that leads into one of my chapters in my current book on the records of flying saucers throughout history suggests that they've been here for a very, very long time, ever since we've been keeping records. And my theory is that they're not from outer space. They're a previous culture that went out into space, was technically advanced far enough above us to colonize our solar system some very long time ago. And what we see are remnants of that earlier terrestrial, not extraterrestrial, but terrestrial hominins, for lack of a better word. Did their bodies change and morph into something different when they lived out there for a long time? Probably. Are they genetically close to us? Probably. And so that's just another, it's just another civilization that was here during a period of time that was able to leave before, you know, Noah's Ark kind of mentality in space. They were able to go out there and stay out there. Now, the reason my argument makes more sense to me than anyone else's is that if you look at the genetic system in our DNA, it's our I'm a short-term catastrophe philosopher kind of person that says DNA has been proven to modify itself on a short-term, very short-term cycle, one and two generations. We've been able to observe it in the laboratory doing that. We've never been able to establish or prove long-term genetic change over a long period of time. Never been able to see that. It's the argument in science that that's how we evolved, but there's no scientific proof of it. Where there is scientific proof of short-term modification based on environment, I go even one step further than that, that says that that modification occurs in sometimes a generation, and that creation is built in to two things: the written non-use DNA code that we look at and call it's been called junk code up till now, which in my opinion, I'm also a programmer. I write program code and have for a long time. And when you look at program code, there's an instruction set in the coding that defines what the working code is going to do. You follow? It's called commenting or instruction. The so-called dead code or non-readable code in DNA is just instruction code for the DNA to build a exoskeleton body once that code finds itself in water. And the reason that I say that, I know I'm getting a little far afield, but life has been demonstrated to spontaneously erupt in what's called natural water or revitalized water, perfect water, filtered through sun, spontaneous life will erupt out of that. And that's a fact. It's just a scientific fact. Right now, science has been looking at the development of life outside of the space capsule at the International Space Station, where when water droplets condense on the outside glass, algae forms. You follow? Now, there's absolutely nothing in space that's alive to give the water a jolt. And everybody used to argue, well, it can't start in water because there's no electricity, to start it. But we're observing that it happens. So that means that if DNA is in fact code that specifies a body structure based on the environment that it finds itself in, and that defines why there's 44 million species of species on this earth of life, trees, birds, plants, animals, insects, and so on. They fish and go ahead.
No, I was just thinking what you were saying, that the sudden creation of life, have you heard of the Akari insect experiment that happened in the early 1800s?
No, I haven't. I'm sorry.
Well, a scientist basically tried to use electricity, and he was just, I don't know exactly what happened because I've discussed this so many times, but with electricity, he hit some rocks with it, and all of a sudden, insects appeared.
Right.
And he was replicated a second time. And the scientific community never talked about it again, almost as if life manifested from electricity.
Right. Well, here it manifests. Here's the reason that it does that. I know why it does it. Not only that it does it, but why it does it. If you look at water, water is the key to everything. All life exists within the framework of water. We agree to that, right?
Yes.
That without water, there is not life. Here's what's going on. Water is made up of three things. It's made up of two atoms of hydrogen and one of oxygen. Mm-hmm. They do not anneal to themselves as to create a molecule without very high lightning, I call it lightning, electrical charge. There has to be about 17,000 volts to create the shock to anneal the atoms of hydrogen to oxygen. You follow? That's how water's created. It's created in lightning. Okay? So, if water exists because of electrostatic action, which is lightning, by annealing the two hydrogen atoms and the one oxygen atom into a molecule of water, by definition, life is created. Now, if we stop right there and say to all the microbiologists or the atomic physicists that deal with micro elements, life comes out of the process of the creation of water through lightning, which is electricity, right? Or our understanding of electricity. It's actually electrostatic discharge. Then that means, by definition, that the written code for life, or the building of a life structure, beetle or ant or whatever it is, don't care, comes through that process, meaning that the code has to be included in the microstructure, microatomic structure of those two elements being annealed together. Therefore, the DNA code is either in the hydrogen molecule, atom, or it's in the oxygen atom. I would opt for the hydrogen because it's the second largest, or first or second largest, most prevalent atom in the universe. So it comes from, it's built within that structure because it manifests itself as soon as water manifests. Does that make sense?
It does. And by the way, you hit a nerve probably with some of our listeners when you said what you said about the extraterrestrial craft being here before, which is something that I've come to embrace lately in the past few years, that all these craft that we see could be us. And perhaps the Nazis, you probably have heard the Annenerbe, they went around the world looking for ancient manuscripts, and perhaps they found something that allowed them to build these flying saucers. And we've seen paintings
Let me tell you the current paradigm of research and speculation is going on, and the people that are doing it don't even know what they're really looking at. You've heard the pine cone theory.
Refresh my memory.
The pine cone theory of the paintings on the, not paintings, but the carvings on in Mesopotamia.
You see that a lot in Egypt. They have the pine cones everywhere.
Right. What those are, and I've been researching this particular subject for about 35 years, and so it's the most near and dear to my heart. I went over to Europe to look at the parapet, the edges of the Chartres Cathedral, which has the story of moving the stones out of Ur of the Chaldees by Abraham when he went to Egypt. And that's written in pictures on the porticos and the edges of the eaves at Chartres Cathedral in statue form. The stones, and this is earlier than recent speculation, but the stones are the equivalent of the size of an Idaho potato. Okay? Some are regularly and carved like you see in the early Mesopotamian wall carvings, but some are irregular, like a potato, in particularly in Chartres Cathedral. What they are is a mechanism, is a communication mechanism between the earth inhabitants and the off-earth original terrestrials. That was a communication device between them. Think of it as a computer hard drive, a USB drive. Think of it like that. Now, when you look at the history of the Christian history of Moses and the Bible stories of it, what did Moses come down from the Mount Olives with? I'm sorry, from Mount Sinai.
The Ten Commandments?
The tables of stone.
Right.
It doesn't say anywhere he brought Ten Commandments. We've just stylized it that way.
Right.
In the last, 20, 30 years to make everybody happy. But he never, ever said it was Ten Commandments. He brought down the tables of the law. And that's what it was called at the time. And they were written in stone. It doesn't say they were written on stone. They were written in stone. The tables of the law. Now, if you go back and read the extant records that we have at the time, the biblical records, particularly Exodus and so on, you see that in the Bible, there are many references to lots of laws, how the church is built, the tabernacle, how the element that was ended up being put into the Ark of the Covenant, how it functioned, how it was to be cleaned. All of those things are written records that are still there. Anybody can go look at them. They're not just 10. There were 10, the 10 commandments are inside those rules and laws, but that's not all that was there. So they were the table of the law, the tables of the law written in stone. And if you copied the Supreme Court rulings and all of the law of the land onto a 2 gigabyte USB drive, you would, to a person that didn't know any other way to describe it, you're looking at tables of the law written in stone. You follow? And that stone was some kind of hard material, stone-like, that was the equivalent of a computer USB drive that had, it also had communication capabilities, instructions, information, lots of other information, so that we were able to use it in a biological kind of way to create food, manna, other. I also think that it was used in Christian times as the miracle of the loaves and fishes, those kind of things. So that piece of technology, whatever it was, stones for lack of a better word, came into the possession of, our current civilization during that time, and has when, if you look through history, everything in history revolves around the search for it and the control of it. Moses had it initially. I'm sorry, Abraham took it from, now, where was Abraham from? He was from Ur of the Chaldees. Remember that Ur of the Chaldees is the center of civilization as we know it. Okay? All laws, mathematics, writing, everything came from that area. So that was a survival area after the flood. You follow? And it held data and information. And someone there had kept some of the stones. My understanding, there was 5 of them. Moses took 3. I'm sorry, I keep saying Moses. I apologize. Abraham took 3 with him to go to Egypt to make peace with. It was his peace offering to make peace with the pharaohs. He gave, somehow, he developed a relationship with the mother of Ishmael, and somehow they ended up with the broken stone that is now in the corner of the Kaaba in Mecca. Same stone. It's just the one that was broke when Moses came off the mountain of Mount Sinai and the stone broke. But he left Egypt with two. And he had the other with him. And if you look at all the great fights in history, it's over the control of that stone. After the trip in the Sinai Desert, Moses is transitioning it to Joshua. It remained until David got it and put it in Solomon's temple, and it stayed hidden for 800 years before the time of Christ. It came out during that time, the revolution of the time, I think, and that revolution was started with it. But it went back into hiding, and the next time we hear about it is when the Knights Templar went to dig under the Mount, the Temple of the Mount, and they brought back to Europe something with them that was so fantastic that they built the greatest system of civilization that we've known for 10,000 years was the 12th century Knights of the Temple. They built great, huge cathedrals. They built a political system, and they eventually were...
You're talking about the Gothic cathedrals?
Right.
Yeah.
And they were eventually killed for it, and it went back into hiding. And in my opinion, it only came out in about 1945 or 1946. The communication with the what we call extraterrestrials, I call original terrestrials, began in earnest in 1943. Okay? The Roswell incident and so on.
That's 47, actually.
I'm sorry, 47. But there's evidence of it earlier than that. Did the Germans get it? They were willing to kill every Jew in the world to trade for it, I'm sure. I'm sure that's what that was about. We'll kill you all unless you give it to us. Did they get it? Maybe.
If they got it, John, if they got it, then we have it because Operation Paperclip, they were brought here. And the question is, could these craft, John, that people claim to be extraterrestrial, the governments and Hollywood continue to say they're extraterrestrials when in fact it's actually them? We have the technology here. And the question is, all these craft that were around the world years before, hundreds of years before, where were they from?
They're the original terrestrials. That's what I'm saying to you. They're remnants of that first civilization that went out into space from here. They're the original terrestrials.
But you see, there's some people who claim, as you said, DNA, it can change in a generation, right? The same thing can happen with technology. Some people say, well, it would take thousands of years for technology to evolve. But, you know, I remember my conversation with the late Dr. Edgar Mitchell, Apollo mission astronaut.
Let me answer that one particular point.
Yeah, but okay. let me finish this statement and then you'll give me your answer. But he told me that in less than 60 years, his family went from moving to New Mexico in horse and buggy to him walking on the moon. And that's if you believe that we actually went to the moon. But the point is that if in 1918 you showed a picture, a photograph of what we have today in 2018 to someone in 1918, they probably would have laughed at you or told you you were reading too much Jules Verne.
Yeah. No, exactly. Here's the point about time and what technology takes to get there. If you look at us, meaning America, United States, and so on, 350 years ago, we were a primitive, burn them at the stake kind of society. Okay. We might have had a little bit of technology, but we weren't very advanced. So we've gone from basically caveman technology to putting a man in outer space or a vehicle in outer space. Whether we went to the moon or not is not an argument I want to have here. But all of these things that we've done, you and I talking to each other, FaceTime, capable computers that are enormously sophisticated, all of the world's data that is ever known can fit on the head of a pin. That has all occurred in less than 350 years. So that's including our outer space travel. So it's ridiculous to assume that we have to have long-term evolution to support high technology. We don't. And the reason we don't is we can prove it with our own civilization. And most of that technology is really achieved, as you said a little bit ago, accurately within the last 100 years. Okay? So it didn't take anything to get to a high level of technology. That's a capability that we have inherently. And so to suggest that other terrestrials besides us could not have built a space technology because they didn't have the time is just rhetoric. It doesn't mean anything. It's meaningless because we've proven we can't. So they could too. So any period of time that's 400 years and enough population, they're going to create a rapidly advancing civilization. They've done that before. That's why they're here. I mean, I don't see any other explanation about biological entities that come from some other place in the universe having the same genetic markers that we have without being from this environment. In other words, if we have 44 million species on this planet, and every one of them biologically not very different, they're adapted to our particular biological envelope on this Earth, it's almost ridiculous to say that any other biological, any other environment on any other exoplanet out in the universe would develop body structures like similar to ours. It just wouldn't happen.
And an immune system resistant to our bugs.
Yeah, exactly. You know, biologically similar. It just isn't, it couldn't happen because you would have to have an exact duplicate. Now, a duplicate of our environment, of our air, carbon dioxide, atmosphere, gravity, et cetera, to produce the bodies that are similar to ours. And no environment out there is going to be exactly similar. It's going to be different enough that it would create what we would probably consider as gargoyles or extreme creatures like on Alien or something. We don't know what it would produce, but it's highly unlikely that it would produce anything like the biological entities on Earth. And they're so demonstrably different from each other that we don't even see, except biologically, a similarity between, say, a sea cucumber laying on the ocean side and human beings, although there is a very strong DNA match between them. But if they came from Mars, they wouldn't look anything, not Mars, but anywhere out there in the solar system, they wouldn't look anything like us. So that's my whole take on the extraterrestrials. And I know I make a lot of people mad when I say I just don't believe they're extraterrestrials. I believe they're original terrestrials from here that went out when they knew a cataclysm was coming. built some kind of space vehicle that was an ark of some kind and went out there and stayed in space until the Earth turned back into an environment that they can survive in and maybe hasn't even to this day.
Yeah, and Hollywood tells us about it all the time in some of their series. But what I mentioned about the Akari insect, it's actually an experiment with crystals. The person was trying to hit crystals with electricity, and that's how the Akari insects were manifested, abiogenesis. But that's a different topic. And before we close the first segment, let me just say this, because part two is going to be even more fascinating, folks. Take a look at the Panama Canal for a moment. It was the single most expensive construction project in American history at the time. It cost Americans $375 million, which in today's money, it would cost $9.3 billion. 75,000 people built the canal, and 5,609 died of diseases and accidents. If the Panama Canal is small in comparison to others you have found, I want you to tell us how big, how deep, how wide the others are, and how many resources and people would they have needed in order to create those. But how can people learn more about your work? Let's give me the answer on the other side, but how can people buy your books and learn more about your work, John?
I don't have any for sale. They're all free. They're up on my book is Earth Epics. Just go to earthepics.com. Earth Epics is earthepoch.com, and they can download my book for free.
If they want to buy the physical copy, can they do that?
No, it's a download of a PDF.
It's all ebooks. Now, excellent.
One of the things I'm shopping for on my second book is to get a publisher that will publish my third book and Earth Epics as well as two books. I'm getting enough recognition and publicity now that I think that it's time to probably start packaging them up as hardcover books.
Indeed, and I'm not surprised that you're getting the recognition that you deserve. And folks, you know, I don't like to talk about when we have technical issues on this program, suspicious stuff, audio that becomes deleted on one side and not the other. But in the last few days, John and I just lost contact with each other. I was sending emails, he was sending me emails, and we have multiple ones, and we were not getting in touch with each other. So I thought that something had happened with John, and we almost had to cancel this, but I'm glad that somebody else helped us connect again, and he's here. But things like this happen, not surprisingly, with a lot of the information that you are discussing would shatter the status quo. But folks, don't go anywhere. I'm Mel Fabregas, delighted to be here with my special guest today, John Tenson, directly from Florida. Much more when we return. You're listening to Veritas. Don't go anywhere.
Thank you for listening to the first part of this very important Veritas interview. To listen to the rest and all of our material, proceed to the members section or subscribe at veritasradio.com. Don't forget to visit the Veritas store for MMS, hemp oil, pure organic sulfur, and other great products. Thank you.